4:55 on November 4th. Okay, so any questions now about the project? We had another couple days to go on with it. Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh, yes.
Why
is that? How is that possible?
Yeah, it doesn't really work.
Okay.
It seems to me that there should be some kind of a listener.
Okay. So...
Because the connects will succeed even if there's no other route.
Right. So the thing that's going on here is that in this project we're using UDP rather than TCP. And a connected UDP socket is purely a local phenomenon on the host that does the connect. It just says, set up the data structures for this socket so the only other socket I can talk to, or by which I mean port and host number, is this one. Okay, so there's no interaction associated with the other host when that's going on. Okay, so it's this is a slightly unusual use of UDP ports. I just wanted to expose you to it. We didn't have to do it that way. You can certainly do a receive from on a UDP port and find out who it was that sent to you each time, but I just thought it would be interesting to do it this way so that you'd seen it. Okay? So that's the difference. There's not actually any interaction associated with that connect. Okay? The code that I provide for that is actually not even sample code. It's supposed to just do what you need it to do. Okay? If it doesn't, please let me know, because that was my intention. And this is the kind of thing that we sometimes call as bit rot or code rot. I wrote that code for a project some time ago, and interfaces change slightly, even though nobody really advertises it very much. And sometimes code that worked 5 years ago doesn't work anymore. So I think it's still okay. Nobody said it's broken, so I think it's probably fine. And that's a pretty stable, the socket interface is a pretty stable interface, so I think it should be okay. All right, other questions? So we're talking about wireless, and we finished up talking about hidden terminals, and we're about to start on CDMA. And I said I didn't want to talk about that last time, but I do this time, so that's where we'll start. CDMA stands for Code Division Multiple Access. You know, we've talked about time division, we've talked about frequency division multiple access, we've talked about statistical multiple access, or probabilistic multiple access, like on the Ethernet. And code division multiple access is a little bit mind-bending, I think, compared with those. It's pretty clear to see what it means to say, you take this slot and I'll take that slot, and so on and so forth, or you take this color, I'll take that color. Code division multiple access involves multiplying the sent signal by a code prior to sending it, and it turns out that if you choose the codes in the right way, receivers can extract the signal associated with a particular sender by using the sender's code. We're going to see how that works. So the code is called a chipping sequence. And I'm not quite sure why it's called chipping sequence, but I've heard this used in other contexts to talk about sort of at the sub-bit level calling a signal that goes faster than the actual bits you're sending a chip. Has nothing to do with silicon or integrated circuits or anything like that. It's just a signal processing sort of term. So you take your original data that you want to send and you multiply it by this code, and when you get to the receiver, you take what you received and again multiply it by the code, and what you get out is a signal that represents what was originally sent. And the thing that is interesting is that multiple senders can be sending at the same time, and different receivers using different codes can extract the original signal for any of them if the codes are chosen appropriately. So here's a diagrammatic version of what's going on. We represent the signals, the original signals and the code sequences as 1 and minus 1 rather than 1 and 0. That doesn't change anything as far as the information is contained, but it does change the mathematical behavior of these things when you do multiplication. If you multiply by 0, things disappear. You multiply by minus 1 and they change sign, but they're still present. So here's an example. The original data being sent is a minus 1 and then a 1. So they're nice, big, fat, wide bits. You've got the chips going on at a higher frequency here, 8 times as high. And the code for this one is 1, 1, 1, minus 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. Okay, so that's the code. And you see that code is repeated along and multiplied by each bit in turn as it shows up. Okay, so you do that multiplication. And what do you get out? Well, you get something that looks like this. You've multiplied the 1 by the minus. You flipped over the code in the first case because the bit was a minus 1, and you kept the code the same in the second case. All that clear? And it's a very simple process. It's just multiplication of 1 and minus 1. And what does it mean? It means you either transmit the code or you transmit the mirror image of the code for each bit. Okay, well then suppose that we have a receiver. We multiply the code again by the received signal. See, this signal here is what the receiver sees. We multiply it by the code, and what do we get out? We get the original signal. Okay. All right, so that's how it works in the case of no interference. But suppose there's interference. Now we have two signals. One is a minus 1 and a 1, and the other one is 2 1s. It's the characteristic of the radio channel that if I'm sending from two different sources at the same time, it's additive in some sense. Now, that's being very sloppy with the electronic, with the electromagnetics of what happens. But in some sense, it's additive, right? You get ones and twos now, you get twos and zeros depending on whether you add two ones, a one and a minus one, or two minus one. So things are either two or zero or minus two. Okay, so now we multiply that signal by our original chipping code and divide by a sort of a normalization constant that has to do with the number of signals that we're getting, and lo and behold, we actually recover the sender 1 signal at receiver 1. A different receiver using the other code would recover signal 2. Okay, so this is the sort of pure ideal version of this, because like I said, radio signals don't actually add that way, for one thing, and different signals with different strengths will arise because some senders are farther away than other ones. So you sort of have to do a lot more analysis to see that this actually works in practice. But what I've been reading about, the book is really very sketchy about this, so I wanted to do some additional reading. This scheme requires precise synchronization of all the senders. Right? They all have to line up in time. You have to start each chip at the same time at all the senders. And that's okay in a sort of fixed infrastructure. But if you have a bunch of cell phones running around, that doesn't work so well. Keeping them all time synchronized to that extent isn't really possible. So there are other versions of this CDMA stuff that use random chipping sequences instead of fixed chipping sequences and use a kind of statistical code division, multiple access, that says I'll tolerate some interference and sort of straighten it out later. I'll tolerate bit errors. I'll use those bit correction codes that we've been talking about previously to fix the errors that arise. Okay, and I can tolerate a certain amount of errors. Again, in phone service with audio, getting a bit wrong now and then doesn't affect our ears very much. Right, and if we're sending text messages where we actually care about getting all the letters right, well, we're not sending at very high bandwidth, so we can afford to have a lot of redundancy. Okay, get them right that way. Okay, so CDMA is used in cell phone networks a lot, both for the voice version and for text messaging and internet service and the like. Its advantage over, particularly the statistical version, the advantage over either TDMA or FDMA is that it's adaptable to the actual number of senders present in the network. You know, we talked about before with TDMA, I assign you this slot and this slot and him that slot and her that slot. And if one of them doesn't transmit, that slot goes to waste. And with the statistical version of this, the result is that if you have multiple senders, you get more interference, but there's less likelihood that we'll lose, that we'll just not use available bandwidth. Okay, any questions about that? So, you know, I think the thing that I want you to know about this is how this multiplication works and how the extraction works, right? By multiplying again by the code. And so I should probably assign some problems that have you do that. It's very simple. Okay, so we're going to talk now about Wi-Fi LANs, sort of the most familiar version of this, and then talk later about mobility. I don't know that we'll talk a lot about cellular internet access. Maybe. Okay, so 802.11 is the wireless, essentially the wireless Ethernet standard. The standardizing organization for this is the IEEE, the same organization for which we have a student chapter down the hall. Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. And it's a professional association of electrical engineers, and also an organization that writes standards for a lot of stuff. It's not IETF, interestingly. I remember IETF is the standardizing organization for the internet. But this is much more a electrical and electronic sort of standard than a data sort of standard. So it fell to IEEE to standardize it. IEEE is also the standardizing organization for Ethernet, say. That's the 802.3 series of standards. So let's talk about standards. Why standards? Well, you want a lot of people to be able to make this stuff. And you want people who use it to know what they're getting, right? It would be sort of awful if your laptop and my laptop required different base stations to work with, for example. So standardization is the thing that makes it possible to share. And both from the manufacturer's point of view and from the user's point of view. So different versions of the standard. 802.11 is wireless Ethernet in general, and the suffix letters say which kind of wireless Ethernet we're talking about. So the most popular one for many years was 802.11b. A sort of just, I don't know. It was late coming or something. So we had B really before we had much of A. 802.11b uses this chunk of the radio band from 2.4 to 2.5 gigahertz. The notation here is suspect, right? This is not 2.4 to 5 gigahertz. It's 2.4 to 2.5 gigahertz. It's much smaller chunk of spectrum than this leads you to believe. Up to 11 megabits per second. Well, that's the signaling rate. You don't ever actually achieve that over one of these links. There's a lot of overhead associated with running this network. And it uses a frequency hopping technique to move around within that band. We're not going to get into that level of detail about this thing. 802.11a, okay, so 11 megabits per second is sort of, remember, original Ethernet speed, but you don't even achieve this. So there's been a big push over the last 10 years to up the speeds of these wireless networks. And that's led to the G standard and now the N standard, which is, I don't think N is standardized yet, actually. Is it? Did it just happen? Okay. It has been years. Okay. And you've seen a lot of stuff that called itself 802.11 pre-N, because the guys working on the standards would have a proposed standard, and people would go off and build equipment to that proposed standard, and there were still problems. So hopefully everybody who bought that stuff got equipment that had firmware upgrades that could turn it into real 802.11n stuff at some point. So a lot faster. How does it do it? It actually uses multiple antennas and multiple channels simultaneously to get the higher speed. So we need to talk about how these things work. They use CSMA, remember CSMA as opposed to CDMA, carrier sense multiple access. Like Ethernet, says, remember, listen before transmitting. But where Ethernet said collision detection here, the 802.11 networks use collision avoidance, CA. And so we're going to talk about how that works. And then you can use either a base station infrastructure style network, or you can use these in what's called ad hoc mode, where you just got a bunch of PCs talking to each other without any base stations. Excuse me. I skipped a page. Okay. So the base stations are also called access points, and these engineers, I'm sorry to any engineers, but they like making up names, so they call a cell here a basic service set. Why? I don't know. It's just a name. Consisting of a bunch of hosts, an access point, and then potentially hooked into the internet, or just some hosts. Okay. And it operates a little differently at the radio level depending on whether it's in infrastructure mode or ad hoc mode. So there are 11 channels within that 2.4 to 2.5 gigahertz spectrum. The usual story is that only three of them are usable. Right? You're supposed to use one of three specific ones, so that you don't get interference between them, because they actually overlap to a certain extent. But you know, you're free in configuring your base station to pick any one of them. They usually say either 1.6 or 11, I think, is the usual set of choices that are guaranteed not to interfere with each other. But if you have a neighbor who's using 6 and he's far enough away, and another neighbor using 1 and he's far enough away, you might get away with using something in between. So how does it go? The host walks into one of these basic service set regions, and makes an association with the access point there. So what's an association? It's just an agreement that we're going to talk to each other now, really. And that persists over a whole lot of data transfers. So it isn't something that we have to negotiate with every packet that's sent, but rather we negotiate it up front, and then we use that association for ongoing communication. So I don't know. See if this thing has anything interesting to say. So apparently in this neighborhood I can see 4 different base stations, or base stations associated with 4 different networks. I can connect to any of them. I can associate with any one of them. And in fact, I'm associated with the WSU wireless one at the moment. I think there's a way here. I guess this tool doesn't have it. Some wireless tools have the ability to actually show you not only the different networks that are available, but also all the access points and the signal strength associated with the individual access points. This one doesn't. And you want to associate with an access point that has a strong signal. Right, because that reduces the errors and increases the likelihood that your packets will get through. So how does my computer know about all of these networks in this neighborhood? Well, optionally and usually, wireless access points send out these things called beacon frames periodically that list the, what does SSID stand for? It's the basic service set identifier, but SS. I don't know. I don't know what the SS stands for. It sends out the name of the network, and that's where these names come from in this list on my computer, and as well as the MAC address of the particular access point. And so the, my computer then selects which one of those to associate with. First of all, choosing the network, and second of all, choosing the particular access point within the network. You've all seen, in playing with configuring your laptops, that sometimes the networks are what are called secure networks. They require you to authenticate yourself, that is, say who you are and prove that you have the right to use that network. Yet other networks are so-called open networks. Anybody can connect to them. So at WSU, have people played with these WSU networks? WSU Wireless is a secured network. The problem is if you connect to it and you don't know what you're doing, you don't get anywhere, even if you might be authorized to use it. So we have an open network called Wireless Instructions that you can connect to, and whenever you use a browser on that network, it pops up something that says, this is how you use WSU Wireless. So that's an open network, and it's just configured so that anything you do there will lead you to the instructions. WSU Nexus is also an open network. This was the previous generation of wireless networking at WSU. So this network, when you connect to it, you get actually connected into a network that doesn't route anywhere. Okay? So you're connected on this Ethernet, this wireless Ethernet. You have an IP address on that network. Unfortunately, packets that you send won't go anywhere except to the router, and the router will not forward them. That's kind of useless, except that it does have the ability to set up so-called virtual private networks across that router. And once you do that, then you can actually get to wherever you want to go. So that's a sort of second-order authentication technique. So we'll talk about virtual private networks when we talk about Chapter 8. Okay? So that's authentication. And then finally, just like any other Ethernet, you have to get an IP address to go with your MAC address. And you can do that statically or dynamically using DHCP. Okay? Yes? That's right. So a hidden network, thank you for reminding me, so I wanted to mention that. It's possible to configure your access points to not send out beacon frames. And in that case, the client, it won't show up on this list, but the client still has the ability to, if you know what you're doing, if somebody's told you that that network exists, you can stick in its name and the security information for it and connect to it anyway. Now, it's sort of hidden only in the loosest sense of hidden. If you know what you're doing, you can certainly sniff the ether and see what's going on and figure out that it's there. It's just that it's not sort of blatantly advertising itself. Yeah, what?
Do they use like some other unique identifier, or otherwise for the networks?
No. So the way it seems to work to me is that within a given geographical area, you need to that the people who are running the access points within that area have to agree not to use the same names. Okay. Globally, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Okay. But within a particular area, if I were to set up something in this room and hook it up to my own network that was called WSU Wireless, great confusion could ensue. Okay.
But is there anything that actually prevents you
from doing that? No. No. Just the ire of the people who actually run WSU Wireless. And you know, in most physical spaces, there isn't a big issue about this. One place that I do see it cropping up is with home routers, home wireless routers. They all, you know, the Linksys ones all come configured with the name Linksys as the network name, so you could end up with multiple different networks that were all called Linksys. If they were configured for open access, I guess it really wouldn't matter which one you connected to. If they're all configured with different private access, then you'll have to connect to one that you can sign into. So it seems it's not really a very big problem. Okay. Let's see, there was another thought about that. It's passed now. Okay, so here's a slide about the difference between beaconing and the host finding out about the presence of the different basic service sets versus knowing and asking about who you are. Not deep. Okay. So we said that we have to do collision avoidance because collision detection is not practical. So why? So carrier sense, again, is just listen before you transmit. Be a good citizen. That's easy, and you should do that. It's still things can happen, but you should do that. The other thing is collision avoidance, and it's the same old problem of hidden terminals, right? Actually, it's two problems. We've got the hidden terminal problem, which is, remember that A can't hear C but wants to talk to B, who can hear C, right? So A and C interfere at B, but A and C can't learn that on their own. So that's one issue. The other issue is that it just turns out that it's kind of a characteristic of radios that if you're transmitting on a particular frequency, you can't hear very well or at all on that same frequency. And so when you're transmitting, you just can't hear anything anybody says. So therefore, these wireless Ethernet things use collision avoidance. So how does that work? I see. All right. So this is the carrier sense scheme, which says listen for a while. If there's silence during that period, then we're free to send our packet. And if it's busy during that time that you're listening, then you wait a while before trying again. Okay? The other thing that goes on here is that 802.11, unlike Ethernet, uses ACKs. Right, so this goes back to an exam question that I think I asked early on, in the first exam. Why would you sometimes want acknowledgments at the link layer? Right? We talked about we have acknowledgments of, at least in TCP, end to end. Why would you sometimes want to have acknowledgments at the link layer, do retransmission at the link layer? Well, when you have a noisy channel that is susceptible to interference, you don't want TCP to interpret that that missed packet as congestion. Right? It will make TCP slow down. Whereas interference of at least certain kinds, you just want to try again soon. And that's what this lets you do. It lets you retry, resend a link layer packet if you don't get an ACK on this part. Okay. So that's why we do ACKs. Okay. So avoiding collisions then is that we So here's the deal. If we just start sending a lot of data and somebody can't hear us doing that, and they start up and they start sending a lot of data, then we've wasted all the time associated with all that data. Okay? That's the issue here. And both of us will not get our acts, will after that's all done, and we'll back off, and then we'll try again later and hopefully succeed on the second try. But we've wasted a lot of time by sending a lot of data that was all useless. So the idea in the collision avoidance scheme used in 802.11 is instead we'll say, I want to send a bunch of data. Right? We'll send a little packet that just says, I want to send a lot of data. And those are called request to send packets. And suppose now A and C both send a request to send packet to B. They're very short. They're much less likely to collide, because they're very short, than great big packets that last for a long time. There's a much smaller window of overlap possible. So it's still possible that they collide, but it's much less likely. And if they don't collide, then what B can do, if B is a base station, is say, okay, node A, you go ahead with your transmission. Now look what happens. When node B says, node A, go ahead with your transmission, C can hear it, right? That's the assumption that's going on here, is that C and B want to be able to communicate. So that means B can be heard by C. So C hears B say to A, A, go ahead. C shuts up. It knows how long A's transmission is going to be. That information is included in the go-ahead packet. So C will just completely shut up for that period of time, not send anything, and doesn't interfere with A's much bigger transmission. So B's response to the request to send is a so-called clear to send. The clear to send says how big a period that lasts for, so everybody knows not to interfere with that. And so we avoid most collisions. Right? We can't avoid perfectly, but we avoid most. And that's the intention of that. So it's pretty clever, but notice that we've spent now a fraction of the available bandwidth doing something other than transfer useful data. So that's the trade-off. We've taken a little chunk of bandwidth and used it to avoid having collisions. Okay. So it's an engineering trade-off about how much you're willing to do that and how much you have to pay. So here's a picture of it. I don't know that it's all that illustrative, but if two of them both send a request to send at the same time, you get a collision, nothing happens. If A sends a request to send and B doesn't interfere, then the access point sends out a clear to send, and during the time of the data, all is well. Okay. So other things that are interesting about 802.11 frames, they contain multiple MAC addresses. MAC address of router interface to which the AP is attached. Yes. Okay. So again, to help avoid interference, it's useful at the beginning of each frame on the wireless link to say how big it's going to be. Right? Then other hosts that do hear it know how long they have to be quiet before they can try again. And since wireless is used in mobile situations a lot, that's helpful because they actually could turn off their receiver even during that period. There's no point in spending the energy to listen if there's going to continue to be signal present. With a wired Ethernet, you could do the same thing, but you know, mostly wired hosts on there, so they didn't think it was so important. You need to say where it's coming from and where it's going to. And actually, if you think about it, once the access point gets this frame, this is sort of wireless Ethernet, it's somehow playing in also an Ethernet environment. What you really want to say is where does it have to go as its final destination, in addition to where it has to go as the access point. And so there are additional MAC addresses in these frames compared with Ethernet addresses. So partly this diagram I think is interesting because it shows how much overhead there is associated with a 802.11 frame. 18, 24, 28, 32 bytes of data just now associated with the 802.11 frame. That's more than on an Ethernet. The bandwidth is lower, so you're paying for the wireless in some sense. Not able to use all 11 megabits or something. This is just showing that, again, that you have to not only say where it's going as far as the access point is concerned, you also have to say where it's going as far as the actual destination on the Ethernet. Now, these days, of course, our home routers combine the router and the access point functionality in one place, so those two addresses would be the same. But what if it were going from host 1 to host 2 here? The same thing would apply, right? You have to say which access point is it going to, and then also which is the final destination host. More detail than I want to get into. So this is kind of a cool thing. These access points can be on the same subnet. different access points can be on the same subnet. So like here at WSU, the WSU wireless access points will give you the same IP address, or let you use the same IP address regardless of where you move in the world. All right. So they don't have to be different subnets. That's clear. And you can use the switching techniques that we talked about before to learn which. The rest of the infrastructure uses the switching techniques, the self-learning switching techniques that we talked about before, to learn which access point is currently the one that's hosting a particular laptop. Again, I don't. We've seen this picture before. Just observe, if you observe the behavior of your wireless networks, you'll see that sometimes they say that you're connected at 54 megabits per second, 48 megabits per second, 10, 2, 3, 1. It varies. My Linux machine doesn't do that, but my Windows machines all do that, right? When you go over the network icon, it will say connected at whatever speed. And what's going on there is that this diagram we talked about before, if you slow down the transmission, you improve the bit error rate, right? And so it's adapting to the signal strength that it's observing to trade off the data rate with the error rate in order to optimize the overall experience, the overall throughput of the link. Okay. Again, power management. See, this is why this gets complicated, because you know, not only do we have to do wireless networking and all the complications of radios and interference and all that crud, but we also want to overload on it, save battery power. So at the sort of fundamental level of the link layer protocol, stuff like this gets built in. I'm going to sleep now. Don't send anything to me. And then the beacon frames. Actually tell the mobile nodes which ones have messages waiting and should stay waked up, which one should keep listening and the others can go back to sleep. Okay. Well, you know, that just doesn't seem like it's really a communications issue. That belongs in a link layer, but you know, it's practical. So we violate that stuff in order to save batteries. Anyway, okay, that's where I'm going to stop. That's the end of 802.11. Next time we'll talk about some of the other technologies farther along in the chapter. Really want to get to security. Security's a lot more interesting. I did, and I don't understand the question. I think we're going to have to look at some code together. Okay. Do you have some time this afternoon? Now let me think. What have I promised this afternoon? You have a break between 1 and 2? Yeah, but I said I'd do that at 1:30. And then you have 3 on. Well, you have 2 on. Oh, after 3 o'clock is over. Why don't you come 3:30-ish?
that would be best. Because I just can't tell from... There isn't enough detail to tell what the issue might be.
All right.
So, but I understand that we need to go over it. Yeah, hi.
I had a question about the project.
Uh-huh.